For many, the 1939 film, Gone with the Wind, epitomizes the pinnacle of Hollywood studio filmmaking and remains one of the most beloved films of all time. A 2014 exhibition and book, The Making of Gone with the Wind, pays tribute to the enormous effort expended to bring this literary adaptation to the big screen. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. Gone with the Wind may be more than 75 years old, but its achievement has not been diminished in the passing decades. The Making of Gone with the Wind is both the name of a book on the subject and a major exhibition mounted last year at the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin. Some of the Harry Ransom Center's artifacts and production notes and drawings from The Making of Gone with the Wind are part of an ongoing exhibition at the El Paso Museum of History titled Frankly, My Dear, The Art and Impact of Gone with the Wind. Today, we re-air part two of my conversation in 2014 with Steve Wilson, author of The Making of Gone with the Wind and curator of both the exhibition and the film collection at the Harry Ransom Center in Austin, Texas. Good morning again.
Good morning.
We spoke last week about the cultural place Gone with the Wind holds for many and that it's beloved by most but not all and reviled by a few, given its subject matter. But today I wanted to discuss some of the behind-the-scenes production facts that really come out of this exhibition and your amazing David O. Selznick collection there at the Harry Ransom Center. We were speaking last week about just the enormous expectation in the public after this bestseller Margaret Mitchell novel Gone with the Wind came out, and the pressure on David O. Selznick for this to be, quote-unquote, a great film. And, of course, that began with some of the central characters in the book that millions had fallen in love with through reading the book and the difficulty of casting those. I guess it's clear from your book and the exhibition that just about every major actress was being considered for Scarlett O'Hara.
Well, yes, especially the younger actors. Very early on, Tallulah Bankhead really went after the part. But she was in her mid-30s at that point, and the question was, could she play, well, everybody agreed that she could play the part of Scarlett in the second half of the movie, but could she look like a teenager in the first part? And she tried very hard. She went through Elizabeth Arden facial treatments and went on a diet, got her teeth capped, and quit drinking, which is a big deal for Tallulah Bankhead. But over time, over couple of year period, just about everybody who thought they could play the part went after it. Norma Shearer, for example, went straight to the top, went to Louis B. Mayer and Joe Schenck at MGM and tried to get the part that way. Paulette Goddard campaigned very heavily to get the part directly with Selznick. And then there came a point late in the process, just before they started shooting, when they were really desperate to cast the part, and they started going to the stock companies at all the studios, and that's when Lana Turner and Frances D and Diana Barrymore and all these people really gave it their best shot to try to get that part.
And there was a bit of a backlash, I gather, from some of the memos and letters you've included when Vivian Leigh was chosen.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, they had done this nationwide search for a new girl to play Scarlett, and focused a lot of that search in the South. For a couple of years, they did open casting calls, as we talked about last week, in various cities in the South. But after that, they had a man named John Darrow who traveled through universities and little theater groups all through the South looking for people. So there was a very public search. And then after that, to cast a foreigner in the part was a big gamble on Selznick's part. United Daughters of the Confederacy passed a resolution saying that they object vigorously to anyone but a natural Southern-born woman playing the part. They had quite a job on their hands to convince the public that a British woman could play a Southern girl.
Of course, the moment it came out, and here 75 years later, we can think of no one else playing that part.
Well, when you watch the screen test and you compare people side by side, and it's hard to say, you know, is it because we know Vivian Leigh in this part, or is it because she was just that good? And I think she was just that good. She had a handle on this part that no one else got. She really amazing.
What's interesting, though, is looking at your book and some of the records in it, that she is literally one of the last people cast.
That's right.
And she's cast after they've actually begun principal photography, after this almost two-year search to find the right actress. And it seems like even David O. Selznick is on the fence whether he's about to make the right choice.
That's right. That's right. Well, you know, Scarlett wasn't the only major character they had to cast.
Yep.
But the big one for Selznick was Rhett Butler.
Yes. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, in those days, actors were not free agents. You know, they were basically owned by the studios. Selznick got hundreds of thousands of letters, and a lot of those were votes. I think Joan Crawford would be great for Scarlett, or I think Olivia de Havilland would be great for Melanie. But in the public's mind, there was never anybody but Clark Gable for the part of Rhett. It, just from the very beginning. But Selznick had a hard time negotiating with MGM. He felt that the fact that he was married to Louis B. Mayer's daughter actually worked against him. I don't think I believe that. But he really had a job on his hands negotiating with MGM. So he was also considering, at the same time, Errol Flynn, who was with Warner Brothers, and Gary Cooper, who was signed on with Samuel Goldwyn at that point. That's who he was really focusing on for the part of Rhett. But when he finally, in the summer of 1938, when he finally made the deal with MGM to get Clark Gable, he not only got Clark Gable, but he got something equally important, and that was his start date.
Yes.
Clark Gable was only going to be available for a certain window of time, beginning in January 39 and ending sometime in the summer of 39, and he had to start shooting. Ready or not, here we go. He had to start. And that means that he had to settle on someone to play Scarlett. And at that point, Paulette Goddard was probably the front runner. She had definitely shot more screen tests than anyone else at that point. And George Cukor, who was still the director at that point, thought she had the minx quality that they were looking for. And Selznick felt that she had a kind of a sexuality about her that he was looking for Scarlett. She was the front runner until they started shooting the Burning of Atlantis scene. And Selznick's brother, Myron, came to the back lot while they were shooting with his two new clients, Laurence Olivier and his girlfriend, Vivian Leigh. And I think Vivian Leigh knew exactly what she was doing. I think she
happened to be tagging along.
Right. I don't think she happened to be there.
Happened to have been practicing her Southern accent.
Exactly. But the story goes that Myron tapped his brother on the shoulder and said, "Hey, genius, here's your Scarlett." Selznick turned around and saw Vivian Leigh lit by the fires of the burning of the King Kong set and kind of knew. What we do know is that scene was shot on the night of Saturday, December 10th, and Monday morning, December 12th, he issued a memo saying that Vivian Leigh was one of the four front runners for the part.
And this is late 1938.
This is late 1938, and the four front runners are Paulette Goddard, and then just out of the blue, Jean Arthur and Joan Bennett, both of whom were major stars at the time. Up to that point, he had mostly been focusing on ingenues and young stars like Lana Turner and Frances D and people like that. But now he's considering major stars. And the fourth front runner was Vivian Leigh.
I love, too, your coverage of the fire, that famous scene of the burning at Atlanta. I was surprised to find that was the very first footage shot and in late 1938. And for very practical reasons, which is they had to burn down the entire back lot to make room to build all these new sets.
That's right. I think that came from William Cameron Menzies. Well, there was a meeting in November with William Cameron Menzies, the production designer, Lyle Wheeler, the art director, and then Ray Clune, who was the production manager, and Henry Ginsberg, who was the head of the studio, the manager of the studio. And they all got together and worked out this genius plan of dressing up the sets of King Kong and Garden of Allah and various other films to look like downtown Atlanta. And then they would just burn it down and get the long shots, but also clear the lot for Tara and 12 Oaks in downtown Atlanta. It was amazing that they did that.
At some cost, too. Obviously, this
Absolutely.
Film is a mammoth production and enormous budget. And I wanted to loop back to Clark Gable because he was seemingly the perfect Rhett Butler. But behind the scenes,
he didn't want to play the part.
No, he didn't. But fascinatingly, looking at some of the documents you include in the book, is some other things that come with Clark Gable, partially of which because he had to be loaned out from MGM. MGM mm-hmm. agrees to distribute the film and agrees to put up some of the production money. And I started to wonder, without Clark Gable and that MGM deal negotiation, could Gone with the Wind ever have been pulled off, at least in its grandeur that we know now?
I don't think it could have been made at that level. I think that was a big part of the negotiations with MGM. Was Selznick, by that point, he had received so many letters, and he couldn't really walk down the street without someone asking, you know, how the production was going, who was going to play Scarlett, who's going to play Red. It kind of drove him crazy for a while. But I think by the time he started negotiations with MGM, I think he had a growing sense of responsibility, not just to get it right, but to get it big. Shooting in Technicolor was by no means a sure thing. He finally decided to shoot in Technicolor, and he finally decided to make one long movie rather than two short films. Mm-hmm. He seriously considered making Gone with the Wind as two films. And the sets and all of that, it really grew over time into this big epic. And by this point, he knew that it was going to be incredibly expensive, and he needed to make the deal with a powerhouse like MGM in order to get his vision on the screen.
So we can thank Clark Gable for that.
We sure can.
One of the things that was difficult to deal with at its time in 1939 and is challenging for a lot of viewers today is the issue of slavery, the mm-hmm. treatment of race in the film, that the film is set during the Civil War period and early Reconstruction, and the Southerners, it's told from a Southern perspective.
Mm-hmm.
He was receiving, David O. Selznick was receiving a lot of letters from groups like the NAACP. There's an amazing one in here from the Central Conference of American Rabbis,
yep.
asking him to take utmost care in dealing with issues of race, not to mm-hmm. arouse, I think they said, latent antipathy for Negroes.
Right.
There was a lot of concern over how these issues would be dealt with in 1939, so they wouldn't inflame the current social condition, as well as receiving letters from the KKK suggesting that box office would suffer if the Klan sequence was not included or they weren't properly portrayed.
Right.
What a balancing act.
Well, I think it's a big deal that so many different organizations, from the NAACP to the Ku Klux Klan, from the United Daughters of the Confederacy to the Sons of Union Veterans, all understood the power of films in general, but this film in particular, to influence how we see each other. It's really amazing to me that the NAACP, that Walter White had lots of other things to worry about. He was trying to get anti-lynching legislation through Congress at that point, but he understood the power of this film and sought to influence Selznick about the portrayal of African Americans. He wasn't really arguing against making the film as others were. He just wanted Selznick to get the facts right,
mm-hmm.
And urged Selznick to have an African American historical advisor on the set to advise about historical accuracy. Selznick also was getting letters from other groups as well. But he was also, as he described himself, a Hollywood liberal with a capital H and a capital L, and he wanted to do right by the African-American characters. And very early on, with Sidney Howard, the screenwriter, they decided to make some changes that they thought would help that situation. For example, he wanted to eliminate any mention of the Ku Klux Klan from the film. The scene that refers to the Ku Klux Klan is still in the film, but they call it a political meeting.
Mm-hmm.
That's when Ashley and Frank Kennedy go off to find the people who attacked Scarlett. Selznick felt that, you know, he could do some good just by not mentioning the Klan in that scene. There were some other things that he tried to do. He said very early on, "I have no intention of making an anti-Negro film," and that's what he intended to do. There are still problems with the film, that it portrays African Americans as being in subservient roles and being happy with that.
Yeah.
But I think the biggest change that Selznick made, and the most important, was as a result of pressure from a particular African-American newspaper, the Pittsburgh Courier, and a writer named Earl Morris, who focused on what he called the hate word. We would call that the N-word now, and objected to the use of that word in the script. And it was in the script. But he made some very good points, and he found an ally, unbeknownst to him, in Val Luton, who was Selznick's West Coast story editor. And Val Luton, he was the liaison with the production code. And he argued very forcefully as well to eliminate that word from the script. And they finally succeeded. And I think that was a really important decision. If that word were still in this movie, I don't think we would be watching the movie anymore. Mm-hmm. We would be so embarrassed and offended by it that we would have pushed it in the closet long ago and wouldn't be watching it, and certainly wouldn't be talking about it now.
You mentioned Val Luton and the discussion of the inclusion of the N-word and the production code. The production code also had issues with lots of parts of the film.
Oh, yeah.
And we can't end the interview without talking about one of the greatest closing lines of any film.
Right.
"Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn." And the battle to get that word "damn" as the last word of the film.
Well, first of all, I have to say that was by no means the only problem the production code had with the
right.
film.
Right, they had lists and lists of problems.
Oh, absolutely. They objected to the depiction of childbirth as being painful. Mm-hmm. They were worried about the hospital scene being gruesome with the amputations. Well, and then there was Belle Watling. That was a whole issue of, you know, having a prostitute in the film. By the time they were close to the end and were ready to shoot that scene, they knew that they were going to have a problem with it. Joseph Breen, who was in charge of the production code at that point, would not let up on the use of that word. It was specifically precluded from use by the production code, he was not going to let up. So Selznick got together with his business partner, Jock Whitney, and they started pulling strings and lobbying the board of directors of the production code. And they had some people who were on their side and some people on the other side. And it came to pass that there was a board meeting, and it was apparently a very storming board meeting. And they came out of it deciding that the use of the word "damn" would be discretionary. They just take care of it on a case-by-case basis. So Selznick was able to use the word.
Otherwise, we could have gone, "Frankly, my dear, I don't care."
Exactly. They actually shot that. They actually filmed an alternate line, but in secret. They didn't want anybody to know, especially the production code. They didn't want them to know that they'd filmed that alternate, but it was, "Frankly, my dear, I don't care."
Well,
they also had a long list of other ones. "Frankly, my dear, I don't give a hoot." My favorite is "Frankly, my dear, it's a stench in my nostrils." But we have a long list of alternate lines that they came up with in the exhibition and in the book as well.
Well, 75 years in, millions upon millions still care about this film, and I'm so delighted that you've written this book and put together this amazing exhibition. So, Steve Wilson, I want to thank you again for
thank you.
Helping us care even more.
Oh, it's been fun.
You've been listening to a re-airing of my 2014 conversation about the book, The Making of Gone with the Wind, with Steve Wilson, author and curator of the film collection at the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin. Gone with the Wind turned 75 last year and was not only the winner of the Academy Award for Best Picture, it also ranks as the highest-grossing film of all time. Steve Wilson has not only chronicled the making of this extraordinary film in book form, but curated a sprawling exhibition on the topic last year at the Harry Ransom Center in Austin. You can see some of the artifacts and production notes and drawings on loan from the HRC at the ongoing exhibition titled "Frankly, My Dear, The Art and Impact of Gone with the Wind," open now through September 6th at the El Paso Museum of History. You can order Steve Wilson's book, The Making of Gone with the Wind, through all major booksellers and through the University of Texas Press. Part one of my conversation with Steve Wilson is available online at ktep.org. On Film's producer is Norma Martinez. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.